Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Compliance Guy. It is Tuesday, February 6th in 2024. And that means it is time for a hashtag Terry Tuesday episode. I am joined by my very good friend, the one, the only, Miss Terry Fletcher. How are you?
I'm good. Good morning, everyone.
All right. So it was a long weekend, but it was a good weekend. And I always hate when the weekends end because that means I have to come back to reality. And that means client problems.
Monday morning.
Monday morning, client problems. So I was telling Terry right before we got onto the podcast today, I had my second eye surgery last Thursday. And my first one was in December on my left eye. And then I had this one, like I said, last Thursday on my right eye. And for the first time since I'm 18 years old, I actually have 20/20 vision. I did not have LASIK or anything like that. Believe it or not, I actually had a cataract in each eye. And they were pretty significant. And when Terry logged on, I happened to turn my video camera on and I looked and I was like, why do I have my glasses on? And it's just out of habit. I keep putting my glasses on, but I will tell you, it is such a blessing to be able to see. It really is. And
it's
a
luxury of life, right?
It is. Like, I mean, everything is bright, white, clear, vivid. It's unbelievable. I forgot what it was like to see like this, but I'll make you laugh really quick, or at least I'll try. So I don't do well with narcotics. I don't do good with Versed and fentanyl or any of that stuff. Anytime I've ever had any kind of orthopedic surgery, or like when I had that obstructed bowel several years back, when I left the hospital, I was on Tylenol. That's all I wanted to take, Tylenol or ibuprofen or Advil or something like that. So I show up and I suffer with anxiety. And when I got to the surgery center, I was the first person to have, that they were doing the procedure on that day. And I had to be there at 6:30 and they took me back right at 6:30. And it took them a few times to get an IV started and, started in my arm. They tried twice in my left and that didn't work. So they went to my right and they finally got it. And, by now I'm a little anxious, as you can imagine. And then, for cataract surgery, they have to put 24 drops in your eye prior to going to surgery. So it's 6 drops 4 times. And again, I'm kind of getting a little worked up laying there, and anesthesiologist comes in and she says to me, "You okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm all right." She goes, "Do you need something?" And I was like, "What do you have?" She goes, "I can offer you a Xanax." And I was like, "Yeah, I'm going to pass." So anyways, they do the drops and they take me back into the surgery suite at the ASC. And because I can't do Versed and stuff like that, I can't do that twilight anesthesia, they gave me propofol. And, when I had propofol the first time after the procedure, I got right up, walked out. Jill and I went and actually had something to eat, for lunch, because mine was a little later in the morning. Well, this time, apparently, they gave me a little more propofol than what I had the first time. And Jill said they actually had to bring me out in a wheelchair. And I looked like the guy from Weekend at Bernie's with my head bobbing and going up and down. And she said the first thing I did when I got into her SUV, I looked at her and I go, "Hey." And she started laughing. She
goes, "That's good."
She goes, "What?" I said, can I get some McDonald's? I don't eat McDonald's. And so she started laughing. She goes, absolutely not. You are going home and sleeping this off.
Going home, yeah.
And she said, I said to her, on the 3-minute ride from the surgery center to my house, because it's literally 3 minutes away. She said, I told her 6 times, that anesthesiologist kept offering me Xanax. And my wife's like, okay, you need to shut up and stop talking about it. And she said, she brought me into the house, walked me into the bedroom, got me up onto the bed. She said, before my head even hit the pillow, I was snoring and I slept for like 6 hours. She's like, yeah. I've never seen somebody who cannot tolerate things.
Anesthesia does that to a lot of people. There's all kinds of videos, and especially for wisdom teeth too.
So oh, I've seen some of those. They're pretty funny.
My daughter's was really funny when she had hers at 16, and it's crazy.
Let's talk about our topic. Enough about my eye surgery. All right. So today we're talking about something that I think is a great topic. What do you do when somebody doesn't follow the audit finding recommendations?
Yeah, we call it when audit findings go ignored.
Yeah.
And I'll kind of kick it off. It's very frustrating, not just for external auditors like Sean and I, but also for internal auditors. I mean, nothing can be more frustrating than going back to an audit and finding the same deficiencies and problems year after year after year, audit after audit. And it's really not uncommon for a lot of practices, not just even the medical field. I've seen banks do this. I've seen, you know, just in financial field, they do this too. They tend to ignore audit findings and they fail to make the recommended changes or fixes. And now you've got a ton of tension between auditors, audities, you know, internal, external auditors. And we just feel like our work is futile and it puts companies at risk. You know, Sean's mentioned the terms deliberate ignorance, invited risk. You know, there's a reason you want an audit. Okay. You're policing and again, this is the compliance guy. You're trying to be compliant and make sure you're following the rules. So once auditors review and then recommend changes to operations, you know, we should feel confident that our recommendations will not only enhance, you know, performance controls, compliance, you know, workflows, but when we see that there's no sign of implementing the recommendations, now we have a problem. And I know sometimes it helps to understand why sometimes these audit findings are ignored. And I know sometimes it has to do with budgets and time constraints, but, and maybe even lack of resources needed to implement the recommendations. The problem is that once something is found, and it is, and I don't like to always use the F word. I'm not going to go right to fraud. But when you find something that is potentially a nightmare in the future, you know, you're going to have a problem. Let me just give you a quick example of something that actually doesn't even have to do with coding and billing. It's actually a compliance HIPAA situation. So we were doing an audit and we weren't even looking at HIPAA. And unfortunately, it crept in, because I was starting to see their workflows and how things happened. And some of the employees I needed to talk to were actually former employees. And I found in the audit that these employees' access to the medical record and the tablets and the computers, that 5 of 20 former employees, their access wasn't terminated in a timely manner. And they actually got back in after they were fired and or let go or just terminated. And management went in and fixed just the 5 instances for those former employees, but then they didn't put any process in place to make sure this didn't happen in the future. And then, you know, a year later, we're finding the same thing happened. And so, you know, and they're calling us going, hey, remember when that happened? It came up again. I'm like, well, did you fix it? Is there, you know, and I think Sean, doesn't OIG call it corrective action, that once you find the problem, then you have to go in and you have to show corrective action and a policy, or at least something that shows that I guess lack for a better way to say it, learned your lesson and now you're fixing it.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. So, you know, you gave a lot of information. So let's kind of unpack a few of these things, right?
Okay.
So first and foremost, when you, so when you do an audit, whether it's internal or external, you know, I always think it's important to do these things under privilege, right? Because you don't want something to become discoverable if there's a problem or something rises to a level of fraud, waste, or abuse. You want it. You want the audits done at the direction of counsel so that you're able to speak openly about it. You're able to create corrective action plans. You're able to determine whether a voluntary refund needs to be issued or it's a OIG self-disclosure. Doing it under privilege also helps to protect against a whistleblower case in a lot of instances. So, you know, for me, I typically don't like to take on an audit unless it's done under privilege and at the direction of counsel. And that's just something that for probably the last 15 years, I've been a stickler for, just because of the amount of liability. Now, when Terry does an audit for an organization and she says, hey, listen, these are your inherent risks. These are the things that I have identified that if identified by a UPIC, a SMERC, a MAC, a RAC, a Mifuku, a MIC, whatever it is, these could rise to the level of, you know, civil monetary penalties. These could potentially rise to the level of fraud. These could potentially turn into a quitam. A violation.
You don't want to get the Office of Civil Rights involved. I mean,
With the HIPAA thing, right? So, for me, you know, when I'm on the phone or I'm on a video conference delivering, you know, the results of an audit from our team to the client, you know, one of the first things that I say to them is, you know, you've got to understand that burying your head in the sand and wishing these things to go away isn't going to happen. That's called deliberate ignorance. Okay. Right. If you act with reckless disregard, which is gross negligence. Okay. That's the legal definition for gross negligence. These are the things that potentially violate the False Claims Act. 31 USC 3729 through 3733. Excuse me. So ignoring these things is not smart. It's actually really stupid. Because it's not as if, you know, your employees don't know what a whistleblower case is, right? It's not as if there's not all kinds of attorneys advertising out there, you know. If you find a problem at your employer, give me a call and you'll get up to 30% of the recovery. I mean, you know,
but I want to bring up something for the internal auditors that are probably frustrated. So we're external auditors. So this is something that comes up a lot. When I talk to staff and I do a lot of education and training, the first thing I say is because I know there's a lot of frustration and something is said where, well, you know, I try to tell my doctor, but they won't listen. I said, you can never come to a physician with a problem without a solution, or at least a potential solution. And what I have found is that in most audits, and, you know, I come in sometimes after people who've already audited, they're like, Terry, we're still having the problem. Can you see what happened? And I found that if people aren't really fixing things, sometimes it's because it wasn't made clear to them what should be fixed. And so, you know, a lot of times they're just telling them what the problem is, but not giving them a solution. And then I'll see something that'll say, management will address. No, no, no. I want the name of the person. I want their title. I want a due date. And I want it made clear what he or she should do, when the deadline is, how to document it. And then I go back in and say, let's see if it's now appropriate. And will it fix the problem? Because we don't want it repeated. And I think any, you know, external or internal auditor that's worth their salt, you have to have a solution or at least some options on how to fix the problem. Identifying is easy. I mean, Sean, I know you have your, level of expertise and I have mine, but I can see, you know, somebody will bring me something, let's just say cardiology and coding. And they'll say, you know, what's the problem here? And in 2 minutes, I can look at an EOB or I can look at a HICFA form and go, I know what's wrong. I mean, I don't even have to dive in very far. But unless I explain also, well, this is what's wrong, but this is how to fix it, or this is what I would do to change the behavior, it's going to keep repeating. And the one thing that we also probably have to talk about, ignoring it is one thing about, okay, well, we'll get to it. Or what do people say about their HIPAA compliance manual, that they only have to have it in the works, they don't actually have to have one? Well, then nobody read the Medicare manual.
That's really stupid.
Where it said it's required, or the OIG on requirements. But the thing that I think is really tough sometimes for not just the auditor, but also for the practice, you know, I want to show them some grace as well, is it's important that when you're going into an audit, whether it be under cover of legal, under an attorney-client privilege, or, you know, I have clients that we have ongoing audits. So we do audits for them monthly. And so they have a legal team at their facility. So we know that there is legal involved, but it's just an ongoing thing. We've had some clients for years. I need to see that it's being fixed. And then I follow up. And so anyone that hires me, they know I'm kind of a pain in the butt about it, because, you know, one of the things that's come up recently, and I had a company that ended up having to self-report almost $1 million, was they merged with a company who was doing incident two, what we talked about last week, and they were doing it wrong. The doctor's on vacation, wasn't in the office.
No way. People do incident two wrong.
Yeah. Seeing new patients and all being billed under the doctor under the guise of incident two. And after I head planted and basically my head exploded, I'm like, you can't do that. They're like, well, can we just go on from here and say, you know, we won't do that anymore? No, you got paid 100% of a fee schedule that you didn't compliantly, you know, obtain. You got it fraudulently. So, you know, and then if there's something that's not fraudulent, let's just say it's non-compliant, and there is a difference. You and I know that, you know that. It's just not the way to do things. You have to show, or at least give an opportunity or give them some guidance. And in writing, people need to follow a plan of how to change that workflow, how to change that behavior. And I mentioned HIPAA. You know, one thing that is a problem right now is the fact that people in the office don't know when to zip it. You don't know who's listening. You know, you don't know who's can take that information in the waiting room if you don't have partitions, and go tell somebody. And, you know, or you're giving somebody information that's not entitled to it. And so there has to be some kind of written policies. And when I say written, there has to be something people can pick up and follow. Otherwise, you're setting your staff up to fail. So not just in audits, but policies, workflows. Once things are identified, whether it be coding, billing, reimbursement, I mean, oh my gosh, look at the audits on the COVID funds and all that, that nobody, there's no paper trails. Maryland is in big trouble for that. You know, it's just, you have to be able, you can't ignore it. And so, Sean, I wanted to send something over to you, because I know you deal with this more than I ever would. Let's just say a practice ignored an audit and it was pretty bad audit. Then what happens when it comes to you? And their only defense is, well, we just never got to it.
Oh, well, you know, first, I always ask the question when somebody wants to retain my services, whether it's for compliance services, audits, or legal services, you know, from a strategic litigation standpoint. Again, I'm not a lawyer. I don't provide legal services.
And there are some things we have to say no to, because we look at it and go, we're running the other way fast.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but, you know, I get retained almost on a daily basis by law firms across the country. And, you know, I always ask the question out of the gate, you know, how risk adverse are you? Or how risk adverse is your client? You know, how much risk is too much risk? Because I need to know. I need to have a firm grasp and understanding of what is my potential exposure, what is my potential liability in the event that we make recommendations based on solid audit findings using cited authoritative information, and the client disregards us, doesn't do what we advise them to do or recommend them to do as a corrective action. What is my risk exposure? Because some of you, and I want people to hear this very clearly, and I think this is important, obviously, for folks like Christine Hall and Terry Fletcher and, you know, Stephanie Howard and, you know, all of the consultants that do the kind of work we do. If you are party to an organization that is, or an entity that is engaged in behavior that the government determines to be abusive, fraudulent, malicious, nefarious, you will be investigated as well. I was issued my own, my brain just stopped working momentarily, Terry. Last year, I was issued a disclosure, if you will, from the Department of Justice, a civil investigative demand. Good God. CID. I can't believe my brain shut down for a moment. And when I was issued the CID, I was given a heads up by a person who I know at the Office of Inspector General who said, hey, just want you to know you're going to be served with a CID. And I was like, for what? And they told me that it was this client. And I explained to the OIG agent that I had terminated this client. They were not my client. They had not been my client for several months, and I terminated them because of their lack of engagement, their lack of willing to carry out the corrective action plan that we have created for them. Didn't change the fact that the prosecutor wanted my oral testimony, wanted to make a determination as to whether or not I was whether I was complicit in my role as a compliance professional or whether I was a culprit and I was engaged in part of the scheme to defraud the federal government. For almost 4 months of my life in 2023, it was paralyzing. Every day, knowing that there was this civil investigative demand that was hanging over my head, that I, Sean Weiss, after 29 years of working in this industry, giving everything that I had to the companies I worked for, the groups I work with, the providers I advocate for, the consultants that I collaborate with, that I'm being investigated for potential fraud, waste, or abuse tied to a client who I terminated. But you know, after 4 months, I gave 6 hours of oral testimony to the DOJ. And at the very end, the prosecutor said to me, Mr. Weiss, thank you for your transparency. Thank you for engaging in a meaningful dialogue. Thank you for not looking at your attorney for guidance on how to answer questions and being forthcoming. I don't expect you will ever hear from me again. Thank you. And that was a relief, right? But, you know, for 4 months, Terry, I sat there almost on a daily basis because I'm such an OCD personality, thinking about what could I have done differently? Should I have done things differently? How could I have done things differently? And did I really contribute to the potential fraud, waste, and abuse against the federal government by not speaking out, you know? And it just runs through your mind. And I share this story because you brought up a really good point. If you're engaged to do consulting work for an organization and you uncover problems, what is your obligation to disclose? Well, and that's why I love attorneys being involved, because they can guide you.
And I had one like this where it was a long-term client. They're still a client, and that, you know, for over 20 years, and they're doing vein stripping and no, I'm sorry, vein ablations. Well, they are doing them on veins that aren't FDA approved. And so I didn't know. And so then their attorney got involved because the DOJ did an inquiry saying, and you know, when any amount of volume for coding, billing, or anything, it is an uptick versus their peers in a geographical location. You know, let's say that you're a cardiologist that, you know, does 200 echoes a year, and then all of a sudden somebody in your practice does 1,000. You know, that's gonna be a problem. I'm not saying you can't do it, but somebody's gonna say, wait, okay, what happened? Well, this happened with this vein ablation, and they decided not to do them bilaterally in the same session because you got more money. They decided not to do them in the hospital because we know facility versus non-facility is different. So they did it in their own office-based lab, which means they were getting, about 400% more money. So there's a lot going on there. It's since been resolved, so I can talk about it. But one of the things I noticed, and I did recommend that they were coming after probably close to a couple million dollars. I got it cut down to about 80,000. They were coming after the practice and just saying they can't do this. And I luckily was able to show medical necessity, show other LCDs in other states, because this state didn't have one. And so I had to really work to show, you know, that this state was a little behind in the thing. But the one thing there is that the doctors wanted to have net zero, where they didn't have to pay anything. And I'm like, you know, you do have some issues here, you know, in between. You didn't see the patient with an E&M service. And so basically you let a whole 2 years go by sometimes in a patient and then just scheduled it instead of bringing them back to see if their condition changed. I mean, it's kind of like Sean doing an H&P a year ago and then telling a patient, oh yeah, that's still valid for, you know, a colon surgery tomorrow. No, it's not. And so things like that, identifying that and then letting them know that that has to be refunded and following through to let them know, I'm going to be on top of this until it is refunded. And it's funny because the attorneys who work for the providers, they're like, okay, is there any way, they don't say get around it, but is there any way that they don't have to pay this? Or is there any way that, you know, we can find that this was okay? And some, yes, obviously some things, yes, because it didn't turn out to be over 3 million, but some things I'm like, no, this one needs to go back. And I think one thing that's kind of speaks to healthcare attorneys now, make sure if you are engaged with an attorney, it is healthcare related, is that they understand that somebody's going to have to pay. Somebody's going to have to, you know, realize that to get things resolved, and let's face it, a lot of this stuff is settled and it's usually with money. It's rarely goes to court. It does go to court, but only really if there's fraud, not if there's just miscommunication or misapplication of the rules or whatever. That's more like, okay, well, you did this wrong and now you have to settle it. And, you know, auditors like ourselves and like some of the internal auditors here, I know internal auditors have an issue with being worried they're going to lose their job. External auditors don't. We want to make sure that we're going to still have credibility in the industry, and we're going to just tell you like it is. We don't have a stake in it. Well, the only thing we want to do is make sure you're doing it right. Make sure that you are, have changed the behavior, that there's now corrective action and that it doesn't repeat. And I just want to bring that and kind of keep this, you know, kind of bring this together to the end, is that if we could offer some advice for the internal auditors, and I know this is really tough, and I know you've probably got some stubborn providers, stubborn physicians that don't want to hear it, and you're maybe lacking on resources to be able to, you know, bring to fruition some of these changes, you need to make sure and implore them to do that. And the only way to do that, when they aren't hearing you, and say, well, then I think we need to look at getting general counsel. As soon as you start bringing up getting an attorney, the doctors will listen to you. Sean, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think any medical practice, irrespective of how big or small you are, you've got to have legal counsel. And they need to be not just general practitioners. They need to be people that actually understand the intricacies of the federal guidelines. They need to understand the False Claims Act. They need to understand the anti-kickback statutes. They need to understand Stark Law. They need to understand commercial reasonableness. They need to understand fair market value. Simply having a general business attorney trying to represent you in a white collar criminal case for violation of 18 U.S.C. 1347, conspiracy to commit healthcare fraud, no mas. You know, the other thing that I would say is, you know, conducting an audit and finding potential problems and not wanting to disclose those problems to the physicians of the group, the leaders of the group, for fear of retaliation or whatever it may be, makes you complicit. It makes you a part of any potential litigation against the organization. You know, I tell people all the time, it's not the crime that sends a person to prison, it's the cover-up. And that's the truth. You talk to any criminal prosecutor, any criminal defense attorney, and they will tell you, yes, the crime itself is terrible, but it's not the crime that sends you to prison. It's the cover-up. It's the lies. And right. Concealing audit results is a crime. It goes against your OIG compliance programs. Right. And if you're fearful of disclosing audit findings because of potential retaliation, take your chances. Roll the dice. I would rather have somebody retaliate against me for telling them the honest truth and the facts of what the problems are, and then dealing with that retaliation if I have to in a different way, than to conceal everything and then it comes to light from an OIG investigation or a UPIC audit or a Medicare audit or a SIU investigation, and all of a sudden the providers of the group, the leaders of the group, are looking at you as the compliance professional, as the auditing professional, and they're going, why didn't you disclose this? Did right. you know? Well, yeah, I knew, but I was scared to say anything. Well, guess what? Every finger in that organization is now going to be pointed right at you as the co-conspirator.
Yeah, and they're going to say, what else is being hidden? And right. why would you want to work for, if you know, if you find that problem, why would you want to work for somebody that has that problem? And remember, retaliation, it does suck. There's no other way to put it. It's awful. It does happen. We know it happens, but there's protections for you if it does. And so it's better for you to just make sure that you give these audit findings. And we want to be positive. Talk to your physicians about, even before you enter into auditing, this is an opportunity to make sure that we're doing things correctly. And if we're not, you also have to be on board that I'm going to bring those that information to you and identify those problems, but I will also bring you solutions because I have your back. That's so right. Make it an opportunity, make it a positive and not just a negative. And I think Absolutely. That's a good way to wrap it up today.
Absolutely. I think this was a great conversation as always. I, you know, very, very rare is it that I walk away from one of our episodes going,
it's all right. I know.
No, this was good. And I, and, you know, excluding the first 4 minutes of everybody's life that I wasted that you'll never get back, hearing about my eye surgery debacle, not debacle, but you know.
Yeah. That's okay. At least we didn't talk about the stupid Pro Bowl games that you got 15 minutes into the NFL and then they started doing tug of war in between the flag football game. Just if anybody watched that, we're not friends anymore. That was the stupidest thing ever. You should have waited for the actual Super Bowl on Sunday.
Yeah, really. And then my wife last night, we got into bed last night to watch a little TV. And she says to me, "You want to watch the Grammys?" I was like, oh. "I would rather have my teeth pulled with no anesthetic."
Yeah, no, they're too political. But I'm gonna say this.
Did you see the guy get arrested though?
Yeah, what is it, Killer Mike? Yeah,
Killer Mike after winning so four.
It was on social media. We didn't watch it. But here's one thing I did watch a clip of, and then I went back to YouTube to catch it. Now I'm gonna age myself, but one brilliant songwriter is Tracy Chapman.
Oh yeah.
And Fast Cars. And, you know, 36 years ago, she won first, you know, black female artist to get that. And it was just amazing. Well, she did a rendition last night with Luke Combs, who redid it with, for country. And he went to number one with it. Yep. It was beautiful. It was so good. And her song is back up number one on iTunes. So if you get a chance to go look at that, go to YouTube and look at Grammy, you know, Fast Cars, you will love it. It was so good.
Yeah. Well, I'm not even going to get into the whole controversy over the Tracy Chapman song and the fact that Luke Combs redid it and all the people that came out and were like, "Oh my God."
But because he kept the integrity of the song. He didn't even change the words.
Luke Combs is an absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, artist. He's a treasure. He did such a good job, and it was great to see them last night. So whoever said that, we're not talking to you. You need to go find that though, because it was really good. It was just, I mean, it'll bring tears to your eyes if you've ever heard that song.
I'm gonna mind my P's and Q's on this one, so we don't have cancel culture.
There you go. No cards and letters.
with that one said, that's gonna wrap up this episode of the Compliance Guy, our hashtag Terry Tuesday episode for Tuesday, February 6, 2024. As always, I want to say thank you all so much for tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with Terry and I just for a little while. We'll be back next week with another brand new episode. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, hey, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.